My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And I am most grateful to be here at the State Line Retreat in Las Vegas. And I would like to thank the committee so much for inviting me. This is just the enthusiasm and the vibrancy and the wonderful speakers I've heard so far and that I know I'm going to be hearing after this. And it's a treat to be here. Thank you for the basket in the room. It was lovely. And I would also like to thank Kathy and John for picking me up at the airport. They were absolutely wonderful. They picked me up and then they took me and wrapped something around my neck and had me take a funny picture at the airport. But it was great. Thank you. Someone came up to me a little while ago and said, I'm glad you're doing the second step, because when I think about insanity, Mari, I always think about you. So I thought, well, that's okay then. And, but I just want to share this little thing. I always have fun. U.S. Customs and Immigration, they clear us in Toronto before we come to the U.S. And I was coming through this time, and he said to me, where are you going? I said, Las Vegas. He said, what are you going for? I said, to speak at a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why? I said to him, well, I'm an alcoholic. He said, you don't look like an alcoholic. I said, well, I've been sober a long time. I've been sober 28 years. And he said to me, I love alcohol. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not getting into an argument with U.S. Customs and Immigration. I said, well, that's good. I said, some people really enjoy alcohol and can have a nice life, and some of us can. He said, well, when I drink, I'm great with women. And there was that maniacal gleaming in his eye. And I just had to tear myself away from doing a 12th step, you know. But anyway. So here I am, I'm going to be doing the second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And that is the second step to me is a precursor of the 10th step, because in the 10th step we get a great promise. In the 10th step it said, for sanity has returned. But we are quite a few steps away before that happens to you. And what has happened to me too, and this is just my experience, because I was home in Scotland in October, and my two aunts who came and took me off of the street when I was living in the street in Miami, they said to me, have those people in AA found out what's wrong with you yet? You know, and the insanity that I know and the insanity that Bill Wilson talks about in our program, I will say to this to you today, that the steps have come true for me. They have come true for me in a fashion that is most amazing to me. I spent many, many years in mental institutions, 4 years in and out of mental institutions while I was drinking, on all kind of medication. And I'm not a doctor, but I will say to you this, that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has made me free. And the great promise that I saw in the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous was beyond my wildest dreams. And the reason it was beyond my wildest dreams is when, first of all, when I looked at it and it says, came to believe, I thought, that's me, I'm done. Because in order to believe, you have to have faith. And I am one of those it talks about in the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says that alcoholics like me had a seeming inability to accept much on faith. I just did not have faith. I had not had faith from I was very young, and I don't know why. I was born into a good Roman Catholic family. You can probably hear I'm not from Las Vegas. And you know, I had Irish blood. As far as I knew, I had Irish blood and Scottish blood. And I used to think that that made me a little crazy because, you know, my Irish family were a little weird. And I just felt I was never right. You know, and I've said it a million times and I'll say it again. I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. You know, and the people in my family had just little oddities. And, you know, some of us who are Irish and Scots, there's a little mysticism there. There's a little magical thinking. Not all of us, but some. We're a little whimsical. And I grew up just feeling different, and I didn't know what it was all about. And I just never, ever felt right inside of me. And as I grew, that feeling grew. And I'm very much like Bill Wilson. I'm also like Jim in the Big Book. Jim in the Big Book, it says that when Jim wasn't drinking, he was much like other people, except for a nervous disposition. And three lines down, he's in the asylum. So that nervous disposition covers a multitude of sins. So, a seeming inability to accept much on faith. What was it? What was it that made me different from my... I wish I knew that. I wish I knew why it was that I seemed to have knowledge. Because, you see, today I stand here after 28 years of sobriety and I have knowledge. I have knowledge that a God of my understanding that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous has recovered for me from a hopeless condition of mind and body. I was a hopeless drunk. I had been everywhere there was to go that could possibly have helped me. I had suffered shame, degradation. I had gone to the bottom of the barrel. I hit bottom and I kept going. My life on Skid Row was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. I know what it is to be used. I know what it is to be thrown away like an old piece of cloth. I know what it is to be looked upon in complete and absolute disdain. And I know what it is to have felt the hand of God through the loving members of the 12 and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that has risen me to believe that a God of my understanding would keep me sober as long as I kept in fit spiritual condition. And also that I would never need to have medication again. That is an amazing thing for me. I have been walking around this earth for 28 years with no medication in my system. And that is a definition of sanity, I would think. I have other definitions of sanity. But, you know, part of my problem, and I've said this before too, I don't think it was the alcohol that kills us. I think it's the unbearable, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness. And the way that self-consciousness worked for me is that when I would go into a room, I would feel that everybody was looking at me and finding me wanting. I never felt as good as. I always felt less than. Never, ever could I feel a place where I belonged until I drank. But that was a way down the road. Why did I not have faith? Why wasn't I like... My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. Why did I not have faith? I was thrown out the convent by nuns because I hit one of them. I like to say it was a slight altercation. But really, I was not... I did not feel comfortable in a religious setting. Very odd thing. My father, I found out just a few years ago, was a Franciscan monk. And he had left the convent because he'd left the monastery. Or maybe he was going into the convent, I don't know, but... I'm just joking. My father was a good Catholic man. He left because he had an altercation with people in the monastery. I left because I had an altercation with the Franciscan nuns, you know. But I also had this willful inability to accept reality. The belief system that I had up until, I don't know, 10, maybe was much like others. But then at 10, a couple of things happened to me that if they happened to another child, they just shrugged them off. But to me, they were very, very important things. And it came to be that at 10, I found out I was told that I shouldn't expect anything from Santa Claus anymore. And I thought, no Santa Claus. Now, I knew there wasn't a Santa Claus, but I was a manipulator. So I like to manipulate Santa Claus into my mother's head to get whatever I wanted. And she said, Santa Claus won't be coming to you anymore. And I was not happy about that. Then I used to go to Ireland every year with my family. And they used to take me into this cathedral. And in this cathedral on the altar was the head of a martyred saint. Poor man. He had suffered for his religion. He was 17th century. And he had a blackened head with just teeth. He had been hung, drawn, and quartered and burnt. And my family would sit me in the front row and they'd say, meditate, or rather pray, to Saint Blessed Oliver Plunkett, because he really loved God. And I'm looking at this severed head that's been tortured, and I think to myself, if he really loved God, I want more than that, you know. So it all went away for me, and I became fanciful, I became a dreamer, and I'll tell you what I adopted into my life that was my philosophy for living, and I did this at an early age. I read James Allen, As a Man Thinketh, and James Allen in As a Man Thinketh said, mind is the master power that molds and makes, and man is power, and evermore he takes. The tool of thought, and shaping as he will, creates a thousand joys, a thousand ills. He thinks in secret, and it comes to pass. Environment is but his looking glass. What I had for me was my mind, and my mind was not stable. My mind was not good, but that was what I put as my higher power. And I wander through the world with that. So when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm an atheist. I'm a hardened cynic. I believe in nothing. I do not believe in any goodness. I come into the rooms. I look around me. I see people who look so much better than me. I see people who I think have never been where I've been and seen what I've seen because I'm judging their outsides. And I think, how can I fit in here? And what happened to me is a kind of a step three in reverse. I had had a slip, and a little gal from Alcoholics Anonymous spent the night with me. And the next day she said, I'm going to leave you because you're a loser. And I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. And I said to her, I kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes, these children that I had lost. And I knelt down and I held her hands and I repeated the third step prayer after her. And from that moment to this, I have had no desire for a drink. But now I go back in and I do step one with a new willingness. I am powerless. I'm utterly and completely powerless over alcohol. And my life is utterly and completely unmanageable. It could not be any more unmanageable. I don't have a life. I have an existence. An existence that exists of drinking, going into mental institutions, being discharged, being on medication. You know, I used to love being in the mental institutions. It's quite fun, really, you know. They give us all the yum-yums, you know. The Libriums, Nivaliums, and all the other yum-yums. The psychiatrist had given me a report the last time I got out of there, and he said that I had three diagnoses: chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. And those are all true. I was a chronic alcoholic. I'm powerless over alcohol. Why did I have to go so far? Why did I have to go to the depths I went to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol? Because I didn't know it had anything to do with power. I did not know that power came into it. You see, you gave me a language when I came in here that enabled me to understand what it was I was going through. And I was so beaten that I was teachable. It said that I had to quit playing God. It didn't work. That was the advice I got. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told that I had to shut up and listen, because I didn't know what was good for me, because my best thinking and my godlessness had taken me to where I had nothing of value in my life. And then I got into the second step. And like, really, step two is the rallying point to sanity. To the sanity of the alcohol and the what it is doing to me. I do not want to face the reality that this alcohol is increasing my insanity. It is making me absolutely and completely do insane things when I'm drinking. Incredibly insane things. End up in places I shouldn't be. End up in countries I shouldn't be. Wake up out of blackouts talking to the wrong people. For example, policemen. You know, you can't exactly come out of a blackout talking to a policeman and say to him, I've got a lot in my mind. What did I just say to you? On page 44, it gave me the answer that I had been looking for, and I believed it. It said, if, when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely, or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. How will I find this spiritual experience? I want it so badly. I've said the third step prayer. I haven't wanted to drink from this. But I now have to find a God of my own understanding. And how am I going to do that? I am going to have to believe for a while that there is something beyond my understanding that is keeping me sober. And I have no idea what it's like. I can't go back to my old concept of God, because my old concept of God is so far in the past and so warped and so without meaning to me. I am going to find a new concept. And I remember reading Carl Gustav Jung, that was mentioned by our presenter this morning. I read many things he wrote. And he had written that man has about the same chance of understanding God as an ant does the contents of the British Museum. And I loved that. And he also said that God is anything the intellect is not. God is anything the intellect is not. I cannot think and understand God. God is beyond comprehension for me. I used to look to men to give my life meaning. I used to look all outside myself all the time. And unfortunately, what used to happen to me is these men would start off telling me that they would help me. And then they'd say that I was crazy, and I'd end up trying to kill them. And then I'd get admitted into the insane asylum one more time. And it's, you know, I was talking today. One of the times I was in the insane asylum, the psychiatrist said to me, I'll send you for assertiveness therapy. I said, I don't need assertiveness therapy. I'm in here because I tried to kill my husband. He said, that's aggressiveness. Alcoholics don't have enough self-esteem to be assertive. And there's a psychiatrist who was around at the same time as Carl Jung, and I'll just mention it, it's worth reading if you ever have time. His name was Alfred Adler. And Alfred Adler believed that the basis of most mental illness, including that one that he associated with the illness of alcoholism, was based on low self-esteem. And I think there's a lot to be said to that. So lack of power is my dilemma. I have to find a power greater than myself that will restore me to sanity. And I start believing in what is going on in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I was running around on this pink cloud. It was an amazing thing to me. An alcoholic of my type, I lost my children, I lost my home, I lost everything of value in my life. I've lived on the street, I've lived in mental institutions, and nothing can stop me from drinking. I know that even if I'm locked up, I'll find alcohol. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am doomed to die. And I come in here and I hear you all talking about your God. And suddenly I know and believe that I need a God. And only a God will save me. And I was at this, I got sober in Edmonton, Alberta. And one day I was looking out for God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was looking for a God I could identify with. And I heard this old woman, she was from the Northwest Territories, and she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever heard. And she was singing about her God. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, "Who is this God you have? I'm looking for a God." She said, "Mary, my God's called Harold." I said, "Harold?" She said, "You know that prayer, 'Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.'" She was pulling my leg. I was told the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as the mind. I knew that to be true, beyond a shadow of a doubt. I knew that this body, there was something wrong with it. And read Dr. Silkworth, he told me I had the phenomena of craving. The body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as the mind. But the problem centers in the mind, not the body. And I am going to have to train my mind. And I train my mind, a mind like mine, through the working of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And part of the training of that mind is the belief system that I have in here. Because if I have the belief system that I will get in the second step, and if I truly believe that the insanity that I have suffered is the insanity given to me every time I take a drink, and if I truly believe too, as I do, that I was suffering from a neurosis even before I drank. I mean, a lot of us might have been normal, but a lot of us were not. I mean, a lot of us before we drank were like, not right. You know, we just weren't right. Well, you know, I should just say to you quickly that, you know, what happened to me, that I tried to explain to you, up until I took a drink at age 25, is that all my life I felt different, less than. I felt as if everyone was staring at me. I had the unbearable, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness until I was completely and utterly trapped claustrophobically in my own ecosystem. And you're all looking at me, and I can water myself, do everything with myself, and I don't want to come out. And I try everything possible to come out. I get a job with British Airways. I'm on a plane. I don't like people. It is very taxing for me. I have panic attacks. I can't be around people. I think if I get married, I'll be well. It's funny. Somebody asked me the other day, they said, "Mary, will you do a workshop on sex and intimacy?" She said, "You've been married 4 times. I said, "I know lots about sex and absolutely zero about intimacy. I know nothing about intimacy. I'm not comfortable enough in my own skin to be intimate. In order to be completely intimate, you have to trust. You know, I've tried it all. I've done everything. I am just one of those that was never meant to be in a relationship. The best relationship I have is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with all of you. With all of you. And because what happens to me too, the second step can come back to me in a minute. And it is when I get into a relationship sometimes. You know, I mean, the best example I have ever given is that when I was 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and I fell in love in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to go to a lot of meetings, and the man I fell in love with would go to a lot of meetings, and we both had AAIs. You think it's spirituality, sometimes it's psychosis. You know, if I attract him, he's just as sick as me. And I'd look over at the room, I'd be reading How It Works, and my eyes would flit across a crowded room, and I could see John and I wandering off into the sunset. This is what I saw in my head. I saw him and I wandering off into the sunset under the circle and the triangle, Bill and Bob in heaven. Circle and triangle right there, Dr. Young slightly to the right, you know. And Bill and Bob are saying, bless you, my child, my child. And when I told my sponsor, she said, don't get married, you're an emotional retard. You know, and I thought she was jealous, you know. And then John and I get married, and within two shakes, as always happens to me in close intimacy of marriage, those peacock feathers start dropping off. And it's just the same two old turkeys sitting staring at one another. And then he starts to breathe a bit too heavy. Or he coughs. And I say, I can't stand him coughing, you know, and it becomes, I got to get out of there. So, you know, that's just, that, I'm an extreme example. So, and I'll tell you this too, since I'm on the subject of John. My husband John, I won't go into it, but he had a massive stroke. And I had him home for many years. He could never speak again. He couldn't understand the spoken word. And I had him home until he died. But when he first had this massive stroke, I was 9 years sober. And this will tell you how long it will take, if ever, for an alcoholic of my type to have a normal mind. Because you don't have to agree with me, but an alcoholic like me, I've come in here for the rest of my life. My mind won't ever be normal. It wasn't to start with. I've certainly had the second step. My God has restored me to sanity in a way I've never known before. But I still have very odd thoughts and odd ways of reacting. When my husband had the stroke, he was so incapacitated. He had what was called severe global aphasia, which means that it was like he woke up in China and everybody was speaking Chinese and he couldn't speak Chinese. And I wanted him to be rehabilitated as much as possible. And there was a hospital that was a behavioral hospital. And they said they'll take him in and try and teach him how not to be violent and to operate on the outside world so I could take him home. So they called me down after a week and they said, we believe you're both alcoholics. Because John can't communicate, would you mind doing these psychological tests? We have three books. More or less, yes, no answers. And it will give us an insight into perhaps alcoholism or how alcoholics think. Never take a test based on psych. I did this and I took it back to them and handed it in. And a week later, I got a call asking me to come down. And when I came into the room, there was three psychiatrists sitting at a table with a tape recorder. And the first question they said to me is, so who's looking after you now? I said, my sponsor. They said, what medication are you on? I said, I'm not on medication and haven't been on medication since the 10th of August, 1984. They said, well, you should be. And I tried to explain to them that my reactions are perhaps a little different from the normal person. They saw all kind of potentials in that psychiatric report. But I just think differently. I don't act on it. Clancy told me once I can think what I like, but I got to act right. And I do that. So the insanity in Bill's story on page 9, it's been mentioned a few times in our big book. It said, rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. That's our dear Bill. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. The insane idea always won out. Sometimes there was screaming delirium and insanity. I know what that feels like. And those of you who have had DTs and who have had convulsions, you know what that's like. And then the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And I truly believe, having observed some of my sponsees and having seen the insanity come, it's a very, very, very quiet insanity. It's the type of insanity that begins to tell them that they don't need us anymore. It's the kind of insanity that tells them that they don't need to talk to their sponsor anymore. And the kind of insanity that says maybe they're not different. That maybe they'll be okay and can have a few drinks. That is the insanity that I see in them. I remember looking at this poem years ago by Edgar Allan Poe, and it spoke about being alone, and it's amazing. He was born, I think, he died in 1846 in Washington, or rather Baltimore, when the Washingtonians were still going on. And you know, this language of the heart that we talk about in these rooms, it preceded us. There were people who were reaching out and looking for something that wasn't there. I often think that, I cannot bear to think that prior to 1935, chronic alcoholics were doomed to die. But I was very interested in this Edgar Allan Poe because I also heard that he died from alcoholism. And I remember reading this little thing. It said he was alone from the childhood hour. He hasn't been as others were. He hasn't seen what others saw. His passions haven't sprung from a common spring. And I thought, that he sounds like me. And then I saw that on the October the 3rd, which is my birthday, in 1949, not my year, he was found in the streets of Baltimore, delirious, in great distress, in need of assistance, and wearing clothes that were not his own. That sounded like me. I have been found in such a state. And he had been described as neurotic. That is why, can you imagine how many, when we think about the Washingtonians and how many there were like 400,000 of them, 100,000 confirmed drunks, and the rest of them were tipplers. And then there was none of them left by 1948. Because the insanity returned for them. They got back into drinking and thinking it would be different this time. When I come to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity, I have to have that deep down firm belief that this will happen for me. And how do I get it? How do I get that desire? As I've said before, there is no spiritual Viagra. You cannot create desire. I truly believe that desire comes from a place of deep, deep suffering. Deep, deep suffering. And it comes from the suffering of a person like me. I went from a place where I felt so different in the world, where all I did was rebel and cause great heartache to my family, people who didn't deserve it, everybody I loved. And in order to get out of myself, I found alcohol. I did not drink till I was 25. I had gone to live in Jamaica. I had got married. I had hoped that I would have a child. I had a child. I had done all of these things to try and fit in the world. And just after my child was born, I thought I was going insane. I've wandered the world for 25 years trying to keep it all together. And now I'm going insane. And somebody gave me a drink. Jamaica has 151 proof rum. I drank that. 1, 2, 3. And what happened to me is described by Silkworth. I had a sense of ease and comfort that I've never known before. And for a long time, that alcohol gave me sanity. It gave me ease and comfort. It was my magical elixir, and I needed nothing else. But what happened eventually was this. It made me selfish, self-centered, self-run, run riot. I used to live in Jamaica. I lived across the road from Bob Marley in Kingston, Jamaica. And Bob had a BMW and I had a BMW. And Bob Marley didn't like me because I was an alcoholic. And Rastafarians are against alcohol. And I didn't like him because he was a pothead. I had a gardener who was the happiest gardener you've ever seen in your life. I did not know he was growing ganja in my garden. That's how little I knew. I knew nothing about marijuana. And one day I was in the garage and Bob Marley is there with his BMW and I'm there with my BMW. I'm standing kind of swaying in the breeze, half in the bag. And he comes up to me and he said, you think you're so smart? You drink alcohol. You're a hedonist and a narcissist. And you don't care about anybody but yourself. He said, you think you're so smart? What does BMW stand for? I said, Bavarian Motor Works. Of course. He said, no man, it means Bob Marley and the Wailers. It was Thibault. Harry Thibault, who was Bill Wilson, you know, he was a psychiatrist and he loved AA and he just embraced it when it first came in. He wrote an article once, an essay on the ego deflation process in the alcoholic. And the ego deflation process in the alcoholic is for people like me who have an inflated ego and low self-esteem. That alcohol will give a feeling of omnipotence. I wondered for a long time, why is it? I never thought I was God. Why are they saying not God? Why are they saying, first of all, you have to quit playing God, it didn't work? I never thought I was God. I didn't think about God. And then I realized that what alcohol did for me was so unnatural. It gave me a feeling of utter and complete omnipotence. A feeling of being utterly and completely powerful. Where nothing was above me and people who were below me mattered nothing. Not even the feelings of the people I loved. And I was so sorry when I found out all the things I had done. And I will continue, I will go on and fix them in the steps. There is a way to live in this world. And it's through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My journey after doing the second step was one of great ease and comfort. Because the second step had told me that I was being restored to sanity. That was questionable for a while because of some of my behavior. For a while I was in Toronto, I was a little aggressive. Mildred will give you the rundown on that. And then I set myself up as the AA police. And became a little insane with that too. And some people would be chasing me out of meetings. But it was from love of Alcoholics Anonymous that I did that. Only for love of Alcoholics Anonymous why I did that. You know, I remember when I was 12-stepped by this wonderful man in Edmonton, Alberta. He said something to me that I don't know if he knew how true it was. I think that we get special messages when we're doing a good 12 step. I think maybe God's consciousness is given a little bit to us. When Stan came and 12 stepped me, I said to Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He said, Mari, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches. They fit any nut that comes through the door. And those are words of wisdom. Words of wisdom. You know, it says in here, it didn't do to be told we were outright mental defectives in full flight from reality. It doesn't do to be told that. But I knew that, and it did help me to see that written down here. It helped me so much. And when it says we have written a book about which we want to talk about moral things, I had lived an immoral life. Dr. Silkworth had said in the beginning that before they could find a way to help alcoholics, they knew that at some level they needed some kind of moral psychology, but they didn't know how to apply it. The moral psychology is applied through the working of the 12 steps. It's where I'm not doing anything wrong or don't want to do anything wrong anymore because I have a conscience. God has done for me what I could not do for myself. I am absolutely amazed by what has been given to me. Sometimes my children, you know, my sons who didn't know where I was for years, who knew that I was in mental institutions, who never quite knew where their mom was. My eldest son, he called me and said he'd been talking to his father. And he said, you know, I used to look in my mother's eyes, and when I looked, there was nobody there. But what has happened to my mother is nothing less than transformative. And that is an amazing thing, and that has only been achieved through Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing is, one of the doctors who used to look after me, I went to see him when I was in Alberta, and he didn't know who I was. And I remember Dr. Silkworth saying that he did not recognize some of the men who came to him because they looked so different. What is the restoration that goes on? I like to think, too, that it has made me a new person, because I was never quite right. And I have been made right through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so grateful. My sons, my family, the people in Scotland, they can't believe it when they see me. But sometimes they look at me too and say, you were never quite like us. And I say, who is us? And they say, the rest of the family. You were never quite like the rest of the family. Well, you know, I take that with a grain of salt, because I have an aunt, and she can be sitting having a cup of tea, and all of a sudden she freezes in time. And people will come up and say, what happened to her? And they'll say, she's just away. She'll soon be back. I think that I come by it honestly. The other thing, the other amazing thing to know is that I read, when they were looking for a name for Alcoholics Anonymous, they had brought some people out of an asylum, which is what they used to do in the beginning. They would bring people out from the asylum and take them to meetings and then take them back. And one day they were sitting talking about what name they should give. And this old man, he was sitting, kind of a nodding to himself, and he's saying, Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics. And that's how we got our name, from someone who had come out the mental institution. I think that's very good, you know, because I like to think we're here because we're not all there. You know, it says in We Agnostics, when many hundreds of people can attest to the fact that the consciousness of the presence of God is the greatest thing in our lives today. If there is anyone in this room who is having a problem believing that God or that a higher power can restore them, just look at the people around you in the rooms. Believe, just believe. Believe that this can happen to you. Do not feel different. Feelings of difference in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous will kill you. There are varying degrees of insanity. alcoholic insanity. And you can read about them in the book. Of course, there's Korsakoff syndrome, which is the end of the line. There are those of us, as it says in a big book, who have grave emotional and mental disorders. There are those of us who just drink made us a little crazy. But you are sure to fit into one of those categories if you be an alcoholic of my type. And as it says here, it shows a powerful reason why one has faith. I have faith today that I never believed I would have. Since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's only twice I've ever felt like I was having a panic attack. And I just spoke to the God of my understanding. The powerful reason that I have faith is because I've seen it in you. You have shown me. You are a living example. But the other thing is this, I think that we are the most fortunate people in the world. Because if you be an alcoholic of my type, and you had the kind of mind I had, and you could not stop drinking through by any means, and now you don't drink, you must know that you have been recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body by the grace of God. William James, that was mentioned earlier today, when he examined all these dipsomaniacs, which is what they used to call alcoholics, to see why they had stopped drinking and come out of their own madness. They had stopped drinking, they had come off the street, and overnight they became upstanding members of their community. Cleared out some of the mental institutions. They were not drinking, and they were upstanding members, and they were talking about God. And he found that the common denominator in each and every one is that they had reached a place of utter and complete hopelessness and despair. I am so grateful that I lived to reach that stage of hopelessness and despair, because wherever it was inside of me that the end of that was, it was the aperture to allow God's grace to penetrate my darkness, because alcoholism is a soul sickness. Scott Fitzgerald, your American poet, used to talk about the dark night of the soul as well. And the real dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. The loneliness of the 3 o'clock and the 4 o'clock and the 5 o'clock in the morning. The terror, the bewilderment, the frustration and despair. When you've drank away everything of meaning in your life. Terror, bewilderment, frustration and despair when you say to yourself, I'm going to lock my door and nobody can get in tonight. And you're drinking alone and you go somewhere and you don't remember where you've been. And when you come back, everything's stolen out the place and you have nothing to. You have to go sell your blood to buy alcohol. And then when you can't sell your blood anymore and you have nothing left but a couple of old garbage bags, you're still shaking your head and don't know what happened. And then you're living on the street and you don't know how you ever got there. How did this happen to me? This is a terrible illness, and we laugh a lot in here. But this second step for me was the aperture and the entrance to know that no matter what they had told me for 40 years, when I came in here, you said to me, if you do the things I do and tell you, you will be fine. You will know a life beyond your wildest dreams. You may never get your children back, but you will have a life of meaning. And that was very kind of them because, you know, I remember a few years ago, I called my first sponsor, Cal, who was in Edmonton, Alberta. I said, Carol, a lot of the women I sponsor are being 13-stepped. I was never 13-stepped. She says, do you remember what you looked like when you came in? She said, we used to take you to meetings in a shopping cart. You know, because I couldn't walk. I was not in good shape. And I was a little crazy, a little neurotic. I used to sit with my back to the wall until they finally got me up. I have a little story. It took me a little while to get my back off the wall, and I was shaking. I had shingles when I sobered up. And it was just after coming out of shingles, I wrote my fourth and fifth. And then they used to take me to two meetings, three meetings a day. And then they did wonderful old timers. It would take me in. There was a meeting in Alberta called the beginners meeting. And they used to have a front row, and they'd call it Shaker's Row. And all the newcomers would sit and shake, you know. And we felt a part of. And one day we're sitting there shaking and trading war stories. And I look up, because this guy beside me is looking up. And I look up, and the guy next to me looks up, and there's a big horsefly on the wall. But I don't know if it's really there. And I don't trust their judgment. And then an old timer said to me, "It's really there." I grew to trust, I grew to believe. I came to believe. I came to believe. And it's all come true for me. I don't have time to tell you about the wondrous things that have happened out of calamity. Bill Wilson said once that out of every period of grief and suffering comes time of happiness and joy. He said, "I used to commiserate with all who suffered. Now I commiserate only with those who suffer in ignorance, who do not realize the pain and ultimate utility of pain, the purpose and ultimate utility of pain. A lot of times pain is a touchstone to all spiritual progress. It is a shame that some people in Alcoholics Anonymous will not go through the pain, that they will not go through the pain that is the pain of learning, that is the pain of whittling away all these defects that I used to think was so necessary for my survival. When Michelangelo was carving the old statue of David, somebody went to him and said, 'How did you carve that most beautiful statue of David out of that old piece of marble?' And he said, 'I just chipped away the parts that weren't David.' And I think that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is chipping away all the things that gave me the personality that I had because of the difference I felt in the world. I felt as if I was waiting for the mothership to come. You know, it was sort of a beam me up, Scotty, because I don't belong here, you know. And then what I wanted to was freedom. I wanted freedom from all the things that were around me, the cares, the worries, the abnormal concentration on self. I wanted that freedom, and I thought I could drink it away. And alcohol certainly gave me freedom for a little while, but then I got back the insanity. And on top of the insanity, I had this desire to drink and this mental obsession and physical craving. And I didn't know where to go with it. And I was between a rock and a hard place. And I didn't want to live, and I couldn't die. I tried to die. I didn't want to hurt myself, but I tried to die. I took pills and tried to die many times. It didn't work. I came in here. I came to believe. Bill Wilson said once that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is the chronicle of our colossal human failure turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. I am a total and complete, utter failure in life in every department. And by the grace of God, I have a life of purpose and meaning and seeming sanity, except what goes on in here. I thank you for having me here.